Again, we welcome Kristen Benson. Thank you for this week. It's been wonderful. And to her topic today is creating gender-inclusive faith communities. So, thank you.
Thanks. So I see a couple of new faces, lots of folks that have been hanging out all week, which is really fun. Would you raise your hand if you've arrived or haven't been to one of the talks? Okay, all right. And today, if you've been coming, the first conversation we had was a little bit more kind of getting a foundation of concepts and ideas. Second was talking more about families and kids specifically. And today, my hope is that we'll be more conversational. So on the agenda that I have, which we can change, some brief introductions, and then if we have any questions or discussion that we want to have around terminology and just some of the foundational ideas as we think about gender diversity and gender identity and what it means to be cisgender and welcoming or inclusive, doing advocacy work. And then focus more on what do we do to become more welcoming and inclusive. And I have some guided points, but not a whole lot, because I think this is really a conversation. I do, and I pulled up, just in case we want something, a research project of mine where I interviewed trans-identified adults and their partners about their experiences. And one of the strong pieces that came up repeatedly were aspects of religion and religiosity. So I have that project here if we want to look at it, but I'm really interested in what your interests are and having facilitating a conversation that you would find most useful to your lives and where you head from here, whether it be here at Holden or out down lake. I'm getting the lingo. for those of you who are new, my name is Kristen Benson, as Sharon mentioned, and I am currently faculty at North Dakota State, but will in a month be joining the faculty at Appalachian State, North Carolina. So my child and I will be heading east back home. We're East Coasters. And my interest in this topic came as the end of my doctoral training in family therapy, and I took a course in gender theory and realized there's so much that we haven't talked about from a family context. And my job is to go out and not only provide direct services to families, but train therapists to provide those services. And we're not even having conversations about families with intersex children or families where somebody discloses their transgender identity or has a child who discloses, you know, their transgender identity. I'd had nothing in all of my training on how to have those conversations with people. And so it really changed my perspective and also the focus of the work, where I thought this is really a gap. And this was 15 years ago, and a lot has changed in terms of what we know about gender identity and gender diversity in 15 years. So the conversations we have now are different to some extent than we were having 15 years ago, and to some extent kind of the same too. We're still trying to understand, and especially I'm going to make an assumption that if you came to this particular session where we're talking about faith communities, that you are either a person of faith or connected to a community of faith. That this is sometimes the place that can be the most embracing and the most rejecting for people. And when we think about people's salvation and who they are as creations of God, this has significant impact on the lives of people and how they experience themselves and how they experience the people around them in their communities, as well as their relationship with God. So this is important stuff. This is really important work. So I'm really, really glad you're here. I love hearing where you're from, especially because I think, you know, if each of you were, for those of you who are here at Holden for a long term, I'm sure you leave at some point or you're in touch with people. But when we think about, we span the United States in this room right now. We all come from different places. If we each talk to just one or two people from those places, think about like the network that starts. If we talk to one or two people, and they talk to one or two people, and then they talk to one or two people, you know, it's through story and experience that we start to see change around inclusion. And that's quite relevant when we think about any kind of civil rights change. It doesn't come through a popular vote very often. I mean, Minnesota was the exception with marriage equality on a ballot as a ballot measure. That's very unusual. Most of the time, though, civil rights aren't won by popular vote. It's, you know, oftentimes stories that people share, and inviting people to be more compassionate. You know, and that's really what this conversation is about. We don't necessarily have to truly understand. I hear that a lot. Well, I don't understand what that would be like. Well, I don't understand a lot of things. Like, so many things I don't understand and I haven't experienced myself, but I don't have to. What I have to do is honor the person and the people I'm in a relationship with, right? And trust that they know who they are and what they need, or that they'll, you know, that we can provide support for people when they're not sure what they need. But that's sometimes the sticking point in faith communities. Well, we don't know what that's like. And I think, well, we could go through so many, you know, for people who are long-term married, they don't know what divorce is like. But does that mean we don't have some sense of how we would support somebody going through a divorce? Completely different topic. I hear that a lot with therapists who say, well, I don't understand what it's like to be transgender. And I go, well, I don't understand what it's like to be a man, but I don't not work with men because of it. Right? If we start thinking about like us having to share an experience in order to support people. So that's just a little challenge to be thinking about. So I'm curious where you all would like to go. I have a slide next that's about like some points about making our congregations more trans-friendly, but do you think it would be helpful to have more dialogue about gender diversity and some of those, the terminology we've been talking about? Is there anything that you all want to revisit? Around language or ideas? What are your thoughts?
I would be interested in language. I have a granddaughter who tries to educate me with terminology, and I get it wrong sometimes. So terminology would be helpful for me.
Okay.
And maybe how transitions can be made in a compassionate Christian manner.
Yeah. The second point would, I think, be especially relevant today. And so why don't we talk briefly, and then can we connect right after this? Because I have some wonderful resources that I think you might find really helpful with some of the topics that you brought up. Does that work?
Okay.
Great.
We're a part of a community that is just unfortunately beginning this conversation, and we're not Lutheran, so I don't know if RIC is a Lutheran thing. RIC?
Reconciling in Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah, different denominations have different language, like UCC is ONA, Open and Affirming, Methodist is Reconcile, no, not Reconcile, that's Lutheran.
It is reconciling
ministry. It's the Reconciling in Christ.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I would love to hear people's stories or ideas, or like, I think we have a group of about 15, and I actually think, I don't think it's going to be a huge, I think it's been an avoided conversation, even though I feel like there's an accepting and affirming, or welcoming and accepting. I just feel like that our church is ready to take a next step, and that we have enough friends, I think we could lead it. But I would love people's experience, hearing people's experience in that. How you become, or how, if you or other people have facilitated that process.
And you know what I will do is add to the information that I've given to Sharon for the website for resources, because there are so many denominations that have put together the very information you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So there's like a trans Episcopal, Methodist, Lutherans, the LGBT task force has put together a transaction, and it's a booklet with a whole like curriculum for churches to use. So there are resources available to facilitate conversations that include scripture. So I can put some more resources together for the website if folks would like that.
Yeah, and resources, I think I just want to hear people's story.
Yes, like, absolutely.
What are the challenges? What are advice? Mm-hmm. What you mean, if any, yeah, people's experience in that.
So we can have a conversation here and then have those resources available if you want to access them later.
Yeah.
Sound good to everyone?
This is okay. Something I would.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and there are challenges. So we had some conversation during the coffee hour the other day about issues that have come up in a couple of church congregations too.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I will go on to the next slide and you can tell me if this works. Oh, I knew it was going to go Okay. And these are points to start some of these conversations in our congregation. So asking questions, which starts with terminology. What does it mean to be transgender? And just transgender refers to people whose identity and experience of themselves in terms of their gender doesn't necessarily match the sex they were assigned at birth. And their sex being their genitals, their chromosomes, their bodily makeup, being male or female. And that may or may not match for each of us. We all have a gender identity, the way that we start to experience ourselves. And children start to develop their sense of their own gender around ages 2 or 3. So when we hear disclosures of young children saying, you know, no, mommy, I'm really a boy, you're putting me in the wrong clothes, that child may or may not develop, you know, and grow up to be transgender. They might not. There's a good chance they're not going to. But we don't want to disregard, because especially if that child starts to experience distress and continues that same narrative over time, it might be a good idea to seek out a specialist and take them to somebody who has experience, a pediatrician, or somebody in a mental health practice who has experience with children and gender identity, who have some expertise to do some assessment, because that very well could be the case even in the tinies. We tend to sometimes think little children don't really know what's going on, but man, they really do. And it's developmentally appropriate. So anybody who's ever taken, you know, if you took an undergrad psych class on child development, if you remember, that is a life stage around 2 or 3. So that's not so unusual. But asking questions in community so that we can talk about things like, you know, what does it mean to be transmasculine or transfeminine, or genderqueer, gender diverse, gender expansive, gender creative. Like, we can kind of throw all this language around that reflects people's identities. And I think the most simple answer we can get around terminology is honoring the language that people ask for you to use in reference to them. And that sounds sometimes challenging, but if somebody says, I'm a woman, then use she pronouns. And that doesn't matter if you think they look woman enough or not. This isn't about you, this is about them and how they experience themselves and how they would like to be referred to and navigate in the world. So those all come with asking questions. So I'm just touching briefly on each of these, and then you all can decide kind of if there's any area you want to talk about in more depth. Another recommendation is to engage in education. So in my church in Moorhead, Minnesota, we had an adult education series where people who were interested in becoming more inclusive to gender diversity came. And we had very intentional dialogues about identities. We watched films. There is a really wonderful ordained pastor in the Twin Cities, and we put together a collection and brought him up. And he did a very powerful sermon on church on Sunday, and then afterwards gave an informal talk that people were able to come to during coffee hour if they'd like. And he was willing to ask questions, which is not always the case. We don't want to necessarily always put people from a marginalized group in a position where they have to educate people who are not part of that group. So I don't encourage that. This is somebody who was willing to do that and offered. But by, you know, having him come and give a sermon was quite powerful. It was really even more powerful about that in terms of education. And we had people, you know, you never know when you're going to have visitors in church. And we had some visitors that were so excited when they found out, because, you know, that also could be the, oh, what will the visitors say? Sometimes that's the worry, especially of people who have grown up in a particular church and have some concerns about, you know, these changes that are happening. But we had visitors that Sunday that were so excited and actually had a family member, and it was so incredibly relevant. So to hear a sermon from an ordained pastor about gender identity from a Christian faith perspective was so incredibly powerful to them. And we could have planned that, you know, it just happened, it was wonderful. But what we did as a church council and then as a congregation is committed to learning more, you know, and to hold each other accountable and having these conversations. So we had to make a commitment to become more educated. And that can happen in different ways. It might be a Sunday school series, it might be a book club, it might be a couple of sessions or meetings in Bible study, it might be from the pulpit. It's wonderful when it comes from all of those places. You know, when a pastor makes the commitment to just integrate, not necessarily even a special sermon, but when we're talking about diversity or talking about inclusion, that, you know, we pray for people. Something that was really powerful in my own church was my pastor, every time a trans person is killed, that is part of our joys and concerns. She just automatically prays for them and names them and prays for justice and peace. And that's changing a climate. I don't have climate on here, but that changes something. It makes it a priority. It's something that people are thinking about. We don't necessarily also have to understand gender identity and what it means to be a transgender person to know that violence is not okay. But this is a community of people who experience tremendous amounts of violence at much higher rates. Physical violence, emotional violence, and religious violence. So by choosing and intentionally focusing on having some educational components that can look lots of different ways in our faith communities, it can start to kind of open some minds, help us understand, and also make it more welcoming to people. So you might have a sermon that's about the Good Samaritan, and, you know, it's not about gender identity at all, but joys and concerns. That one statement is made, and you have a trans person visiting church that day, or a mother of a trans child, that sends a very powerful message to them about where that church stands. So it doesn't have to be the topic du jour, but it's a priority, and it's something that we're thinking about. Is this okay with everyone? All right, I feel like I'm talking at you, and I don't want to do too much talking at you. Facilities, now this is a big one, and this is where we get to bathrooms. You know, I shared this the other day during the coffee break. In mine, you know, I have some wonderful, this one woman in particular, she's been at the church for decades, older woman, she's just fantastic. And she's so enthusiastic that she really wanted to let people, like if we had somebody that she thought might be trans or might be gender diverse in some way, she would want to come up to them and tell them where the single stall restroom was. Really well intended, right? How might that be received by somebody? Yeah, don't do that. But it came from a really loving place. So how do we harness that, right? Embrace that excitement and think about how would people experience that, and how do we set up our facilities so that they're welcoming? You know, and it could be that we have a statement that says if there are gender, you know, a lot of us are in old buildings. Right? We're not going to be able to change everything to a single-stall restroom. In my church, we have gendered multi-stalls upstairs and then a single stall downstairs. And so what we try to do is just tell people, use the restroom that best is most comfortable for you. This facility is here, this facility is here, this facility is here. And everybody can get that message. So we're not targeting any individuals and saying, I'm pegging you and this is where you should go, but this is where everybody should go. And that's a recommend.
Also, as with most universal access things, that there are a lot of people with a 3-year-old that want a single stall.
Absolutely.
So it covers more than just.
And this is so I'm a member of the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy, and we started making this change at the conference. So now and now the National Council on Family Relations as well. And this is something like you could do as an advocate as well. I contacted for my two major professional conferences. And we've been having conversation about how we can be more inclusive. So we have national conferences every year in big hotels in different parts of the country. And what they've both started doing now is when they go to contract, you know, because they schedule them years out and they go and visit the hotel, they're looking at facilities. And I know NCFR actually can purchase signage. So if we're at a hotel or a conference center that doesn't have inclusive restrooms, they're designating them and putting signage up. And so they'll have, and it might be a multi-stall restroom, but it'll still be an all-gender restroom. And then this comes from recommendations of the University of Minnesota's Gender Clinic, that you have a list of what the facilities are. So this is an all-gender restroom. It includes 3 urinals, 3 stalls, 5 sinks. And then people can choose where would be the place that I'd be most comfortable. And it's really interesting to watch people who don't necessarily seek out those restrooms experience those restrooms. Because that's another act where we're pushing people to have to think outside of their own experience. Like, why would this be here? And it brings up a lot of questions. And those questions might even be very prejudiced and biased, but it starts a dialogue. And I think anytime we're having the conversation, it's an opportunity. Now, we want to make sure that those dialogues are not happening with people who might experience them. You know, if somebody self-identifies as trans or a gender diverse in some way, we don't want them to have to respond to those questions, but that's where anybody who is not can respond and talk and invite people to have more conversation or share resources. And it was very interesting at my conferences the first year they did this. There was some interesting tweets, like photo pictures of the bathrooms, and then tweets that were not necessarily friendly. You know, and then that also gave us, like, you know, your digital footprint lets people know who you are, so you can respond. You know, but having dialogue about why this is so important. Like, isn't it wonderful? Like, you don't have to worry about these things, but how do we make this a place where everybody has a place where they can go? Because, I mean, one of the basic things we can do is use the restroom, right? The other outcome of that are people who, people have different privacy reasons. People have many hidden disabilities. I have one colleague who was so grateful that we made this change because he is the adult caretaker to his adult daughter, who is not able to use the restroom on her own and has a very, very difficult time in public spaces, because even in places that have a large restroom stall for handicapped people, he can't go into the women's room. So they have a real difficult time. So allowing single stalls and multi-gender restrooms allows that opportunity as well for him to be able to assist her as she needs. But these are, you know, kind of basic facilities. If we're doing a summer camp, like I started, you know, the background photo is from one of my very favorite places, which is Pilgrim Point, and outside of Alexandria, Minnesota. Where are people being divided by gender? And who's deciding that? The people get to self-decide. Is there a reason for that? Like, sometimes when you're talking about 16-year-olds, okay, I get it. But at the same time, separating by gender doesn't always keep any of the, you know, the hanky-panky from happening, because not everybody is straight. So we make some heteronormative and some cisnormative decisions when we divide, especially like youth, but also adults up, you know, at things like a church camp. So how are we making those decisions, and what are they actually doing? What are the messages there? So are people able to self-choose where they want to go? Is it necessary to divide by gender? Do you have to have this lodge be for the boys and this lodge be for the girls? And there might be reasons for that, so I'm not advocating for or against. But what I am inviting you to do is to have some intentional conversations about why you're doing what you're doing and how you would maintain inclusivity. So you might have the conversation and go, well, we've always done it this way. I don't know why we do it this way. You know, as long as we have an adult chaperone in each room, or, you know, whatever it is, it'll be fine. Or you might say, you know what, this is really important we do it this way, but we also want to have a very clear message at the beginning that you can self-identify and choose the place that's most comfortable for you. So there's ways to do that that start to open up and begin some dialogue. Does that make sense to everyone? Any questions about facilities? One of the other things that's, I guess not facilities, but I'm always, especially in faith communities, I kind of want to present the challenge, is we do a lot of men's groups and ladies' groups. We do a lot of youth groups that are gender specific. And where does that leave people who either identify in a kind of a gender diverse way, or people who identify as transgender? Do they feel like they could show up to the ladies' Bible study, or that they could go on the men's retreat? How would they be treated? And are you making statements? So oftentimes in communities, we'll say, oh, well, of course they could come. But there's nothing that says that. And so what it does is it puts the responsibility on that person who already experiences marginalization in their everyday life to have to ask questions of if it's okay they come. So having, you know, that's where the education, the facilities, having statements are really important. That's where this isn't a one-time conversation, but ongoing dialogues about inclusivity, that we're doing, you know, this retreat. Anybody who identifies as a man is welcome to come. Just by adding that word, anybody who identifies as a man, opens it up, right? It acknowledges some sense that we're not necessarily going by social markers, but by people's identified experiences. Do you have any experiences with any of these kinds of things or stories that you know of?
So she's a counselor at a summer camp, and one of the things they typically do is ask the kids, you know, the parents fill out the form, male, female, name, etc. And then they use that at the beginning of camp to mix groups. And so when we were having a conversation about, well, what does that mean, what is it you're really looking for, you know, using that idea of, well, the boys are probably going to be more rambunctious and active, so we want to mix them with the girls so that they'll be, you know, tempered, that energy will be tempered, and we can get to know, but, you know, I said, well, what three questions could you ask on that form that would give you actually better information about the kid's temperament, learning style, et cetera, so that you could either separate them or mix them, depending on what activities you were going to do. And so it was an interesting conversation about looking past the gender marker to the individuals and figuring out what's important about the diversity of the individuals in the context of the camp.
So absolutely.
You sparked her thinking about that. So.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Well, and that leads me to, this is completely different, but somehow it brought this up for me. When we think about course directories, like there's so many things you're going to leave, hopefully, and just come up with all these, oh, here and here and here and here. But I know in church directories, sometimes we use people's legal names. Do we have some way to ask for people, like, what name would you like listed in the directory? Because sometimes a legal name might not match, depending on where somebody is in transition. If somebody is doing a legal name change, or they have a nickname that maybe matches their identity more so than their given name, they might not want their given name listed. They might want their chosen name. And so, you know, even things like that that we wouldn't necessarily think of end up becoming, because, you know, once the directory is printed, it's too late, right? So it takes a little bit of forethought, but it's the thinking ahead, and then, you know, how do we organize? So not the same as camp, but that's what came up for me.
Church, I mean, my church. So even the question of whose picture gets taken in the directory. So you take your pictures in family units. Well, what if people in the church identify with members of the church family? Can they be in a picture together? And, I mean, we've had this conversation, right?
Yeah.
So it can be quite fraught.
And I find, like, in faith communities, everything can be, right?
Yes.
And you just never know what's going to be an issue for someone.
Right.
Yeah. Other examples or experiences that you all have you'd like to share? Can I share the example that you brought up the other day? I thought it was such a wonderful one. Do you want to share it? You want me to? I'll do it. Okay. So what she brought up was... there's a trans woman or feminine woman, a trans feminine person who goes to church, and there was a wonderful older woman who was getting rid of all of her clothes and debating on, she was not getting rid of all of her clothes, but going through and making a donation. So she wanted to donate clothes that she didn't wear anymore, and she was debating on if she should approach this individual and offer her clothes to them. And so we were talking about, this is another example of when somebody is very, very well-intended, right? And wanting to say, hey, I see you, and I want to support you, and here's a way that I want to support you. But in the same moment, might also be pointing out their identity in a way that they might not be comfortable with. Also, it sounds like from the story, there's a huge generational gap, so they may or may not have the same style swag. So we talked about instances like this where somebody might say, hey, I have women's clothing that I plan to donate. Is there anybody in the congregation that would like some? Something that started in my community, and this could happen in a church, is they actually have a trans clothing drive, and they do a trans clothing exchange. Because people who are transitioning may or may not have access to a lot of resources and funds, they set up kind of a thrift store, and trans people can come and select clothes that they would like that reflects their gender identity. No questions asked. So there are ways that, you know, we can look at maybe some of the traditional things we've done, like rummage sales, where if we want to be inclusive, we might have maybe a pre-sale where we do a special day for trans folks to come and shop in a safe environment, because sometimes clothing stores can be really not safe environments. Clothing clerks are not always the most friendly. Dressing rooms are not always the easiest thing to go to. You know, so sometimes we can use our fellowship halls to set up something that, you know, would take a little bit of effort, but not too much, that could make a huge impact, and also says something in our communities. So these are things we oftentimes already do, like how many churches here have had a rummage sale at some point in the last 10 years? Couple, right? It's something oftentimes we hear about. So, but I thought that was just such a wonderful example of somebody who was really wanting to make an effort. It was a good intention. But unfortunately, when it comes to people who experience marginalization on a daily basis, the intention of other people doesn't matter as much. When you are experiencing marginalization, when you are being pegged as different on a regular basis, somebody can mean well, but it doesn't necessarily get experienced in that positive way that's intended. So we want to just be really mindful and careful about how we, you know, would we offer this to anybody else? You know, how would you make this something broad so somebody can self-select? Any other stories or examples? I feel like I'm talking at you all a lot. Is this okay? We're okay? All right. I also think it's darker today. So we started to touch on language, and that, you know, like I mentioned the church directories, but that has to do, it's actually connected to education and asking questions, but what language do we include? Do we only use gender-specific language? Do we have to use gendered language all the time? Like sometimes we use it just because it's what we've always done, but we don't have to necessarily do that. What do we have on an information sheet, somebody's interested in the church or they're joining, do we ask them their gender or their sex? Do we need to? If we do, how do we do that? Do we only have two boxes, male or female? Can that be a fill-in? What's your gender? How do you identify your gender? Align, let people self-identify. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's very simple changes like that that we put in paperwork that also say something. So most people, cisgender people, people who are not transgender or gender diverse, are not going to think twice about that. People who that matters to, it sends a very strong message about inclusivity. I get that a lot from therapists. Well, if we start making these statements and changes, or I have these, like, you know, trans-friendly kind of magazines in my waiting area, am I going to offend the people who aren't trans? And the response is, first of all, that's a whole, well, there's a whole other conversation I can have there. However, what I will say is that most of the time, people who it doesn't matter don't really notice anyway. The people who it matters to, it matters tremendously. That sometimes small gestures say so much to people who experience marginalization on a daily basis. So to have a little trans pride flag up in the corner of a bulletin board during Pride Month could mean the world to somebody in a way that half the people walking by probably wouldn't even know what it was. Not that they shouldn't, and we should tell them, but you know, the idea like, oh, this upset a certain, you know, kind of the old guard, or, you know, that kind of thing. And I hear that a lot, and that language used a lot. Probably not. Policies are related to something that you all have brought up already. You know, like the ELCA vote to be inclusive on the sexuality statement. That was something that comes, you know, from the larger denomination, right? So we sometimes have larger policies, but then we also, and these are things that are changing right now. I'm actually going to pull this up right now. Because this is, oops. Anybody see this last week? So this has made big news in the last week. So the United Methodist Church appointed a transgender deacon, and deacons in the Methodist Church are ordained clergy. So M. Barclay has gone public with their story. They identify, I believe, as non-binary and use pronouns they, they're, them. I generally have a rule. When I see things online, I don't read the comments.
Yeah.
I did read them for this because I felt like it was relevant for the conversation we were going to have here. And I encourage you at some point to look up some of these articles. And do take a minute, prepare yourself, and read some of the comments that are seemingly coming from people of faith. That M is not biblical. That M is reinventing God. That M is an abomination. These are the kinds of, you know, the church is making this effort to be inclusive. This is somebody who is called to the ministry. Hey, somebody who is called to the ministry. And we're going to say, you're an abomination? somebody who's committed their life work to being a follower of Jesus and God. You know, that to me is when I just take a step back and I have to take a breath. Because who is somebody else to declare that about another person? And think about the commitment it takes to make that kind of life choice and to answer that kind of call. So that's where it doesn't feel good, but I do encourage you so that, because I think it's always important we know what's going on. We sometimes see the extreme. We see the Westboro Baptist Church, you know, which quite frankly is a bunch of incestuous people that you know, a lot, they're all family members and they do these crazy horrible things like picket soldiers' funerals. That is not the example of transphobia in the church, really. That's the example of extremism, right? I mean, that isn't it. However, last week was the Southern Baptist Conference. People who were LGBT were kicked out of the conference. You know, and we won't even talk. Do a Google search when you have access to Wi-Fi again about their refusal to take a stand on racism either. I mean, it was really kind of scary. And these are people of faith coming together. So how do people who already experience marginalization then experience a faith community? And that's something that I found in the study that I mentioned, that most of the participants in the study, it was a small study because it was in-depth interview. So I interviewed 10 people, and for like they ranged from 1 to 3 hours. So if you think about transcripts, that's hundreds of pages of data to sharing their stories. And what all of them talked about was feeling connected to a higher power and a faith. Most of them identified as Christian. One was an active clergy member and had the experience of being transgender, but did not disclose this to anybody. Was only connected through online resources, which is how they connected with me. So that was quite a powerful interview. The other is somebody who left the ministry because of their gender identity and fear that they would not be supported. And they all talked about being designed by God, that God made them this way, that they never saw themselves as mistakes, and that's sometimes the rhetoric that's used. Well, if you're trans and you're saying God made a mistake, and they're saying, no, God didn't make me a mistake, didn't make me as a mistake. Like, he made me this way, or she made me this way on purpose, intentionally. This was my life challenge to try and figure this out and live in this world, in this body, in this way. That rejection from their faith communities, because all of them had experienced some kind of faith rejection, did not change their relationship with God. It changed their relationship with communities. Mm. And so that gets really interesting too, if we start talking like theologically about what does it mean to be part of a faith community? How do we start to make sense of our faith when we're in community with other people? And to not have access to that part of our spiritual and faith lives is quite, I mean, I'm gonna put a label on that and a value and say, I think that's sad and unfortunate. But some of the people found other locations, they sought out other churches. This is something that I have in conversation with the therapists that I train on a regular basis, because they sometimes will think, well, let's just tell them where the inclusive churches are. They can leave the church that they're at and they can go to the inclusive church. And then we have to have conversations about what does it mean? I mean, churches can be such intergenerational places, right? Where your grandparents and your parents and you grew up in this church. Leaving isn't always so easy. Leaving isn't always necessarily an option. Like, this is my faith home. And I don't feel welcome here. You know, these are the conversations that I think are so important. And that's where, even if the church doesn't necessarily vote to be inclusive, that there might be safe spaces within a faith community. I saw a hand. Sorry.
I imagine even places that they say are inclusive, that, I mean, places change, right? So even
right.
If it is now, then maybe, you know, it is beneficial to, like, just address the place that you're, you know, I think. You know,
mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Because who is in leadership? I mean, and I think it's important to think, like, you know, our faith communities are more than our pastors. Our pastors are really critical and important, but they're more than our pastors, too. So, yes, we want to see leadership, you know, on these issues sometimes from the pastors, but sometimes it takes the community to also push our pastors. because not all pastors are going to come in committed to, you know, creating this kind of welcomeness to diversity.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said, you know, people, it doesn't always affect people's view of God, but I think that, I mean, it takes a really strong person to be a part of a faith community that is hurtful, that where it doesn't, I think, influence your view of who you are. I mean, I've seen so many people who take their faith community experiences, and it's hard to separate your view of God, your identity of God, and how you experience God's peoples. And it's all the whole spiritual abuse sort of thing that happens. But and so I think it is important as communities, and our relationship with God should be different than our relationship with community, but it's oftentimes it gets really mixed up.
And this is what contributes, I mean, and I'm going to label that as when we reject, that's related to transphobia. And the word transphobia refers to the ways that people get rejected because of their gender identity, or the ways that they might be treated badly. And that is what's highly correlated with risk factors. So when we see increased suicidality, when we see increased alcohol, substance use, increased depression, increased anxiety, it's not because somebody's trans and these things come along with being trans. It's because these things come along with being treated really, really badly, especially by the people who are supposed to most embrace you. That's a horrible feeling of rejection. And what can happen is people internalize. So much like homophobia can be internalized, transphobia can also be internalized. So the message is, there's something wrong with me. When do I start believing, yeah, there's something wrong with me? Or maybe I've always believed that. And that's certainly the case when I've talked with people who are older and disclose their gender identity later in life. You know, we're hearing now young children, adolescents, but there's a large constituency of people who, particularly, these are a lot of the people that I am in community with, identify as women, so they're trans women who did not disclose their gender identity until they were after age 50. They retired, and most of them had gone into very hyper-masculine careers. They served in the military. They did things that were hyper-masculine, trying to hide this part of themselves their entire lives. And then they get to a place where they're like, I just can't do this anymore. And they may or may not be married. So there's some literature on how do you support a spouse of a person or a partner of a person who's transitioning. Because these are relevant issues, and oftentimes they go to a faith leader. So I encourage you, if you've not seen the film Normal, it's a wonderful film. Jessica Lange stars in it. Oh, I can't remember the name of the guy who stars in it too. I can never say it. Hayden Panettiere. The one that's on Nashville now.
Yeah.
Okay. She's a young little whippersnapper in that. She plays the child of this couple. But the husband discloses his identity as a woman to his wife, and they go to their pastor for counseling, and the pastor he does not know how to handle it. But it's a really beautiful story of a couple who stays together. And it is available. I think you could probably find, I'm not sure if it's on Netflix or Amazon, but it's a popular movie. It's not like a special niche movie you would only find in churches. You could find it, but it's a great story. But I think it does give a little bit of an example of what shouldn't we do in a faith community? Because they get rejected. And you see this, you know, where she continues to try to go to choir practice and is trying to change, like, from singing with the men to singing the parts with the women. This is another area. And how they all stop singing and just stare at her. Like, you're singing the wrong place. You know, and then people saying, we really, if you're going to dress, don't come to church. And that's the stories of people I heard that I interviewed as well. We're okay with your, you know, we're not going to judge your identity, but leave that at home. You know, what does that say to people about who they are, what their value and worth is?
I think it says so much too with if somebody, like I think of being a teacher and somebody coming and asking me a question that I might not know the answer to, instead of just coming up with an answer,
right,
how you respond. So, you know, going to a church leader or a pastor of some sort and how they respond to what you're coming to them, I think says more about the situation then, you know, no, we don't do it that way, we never have, instead of, you know, even something as simple, let me look into it, or, you know, let's work on that together, or, you know, just that type of thing, I think, can say so much more.
Absolutely. And this is where church leadership, especially anybody involved in pastoral care, we're not all going to be experts, right? And that's okay. But it means so much when somebody who is providing pastoral care says, you know, I want to consult with some people and figure out how I can best support you. What you're saying is so important right now. I want to make sure we have the best resources to support you. We don't have to have the answers in the moment. But that in and of itself is an embracing, loving response that still says, I don't know right now. It's okay not to know. We don't all have to know everything all the time, right? But we need to know where then to turn. We had a situation in my own congregation this past year where there was an issue that came up, and it was around sexuality. My pastor wasn't quite sure, had never dealt with this particular issue in the ministry, and she, wonderful, like within 2 days, had reached out to her network of other pastors in the region, had contacted the national office, like, okay, can you connect me with other clergy who have faced this issue, supported families with these issues? And it was really wonderful to see her spring into action. And it was just kind of a side of ministry as a layperson, you know, like I hadn't seen before. But she was very, very committed to making sure these people felt welcome and affirmed. And
she knew what she didn't know. Like she
exactly.
She was able
she
to
She didn't just try to wing
did.
It. Mm-hmm. She knew it. And then she called on her resources. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really powerful and important. And then was transparent about that. I'm on the Pastor Parishioner Committee. Was transparent with that, with my committee, as well as with our church council. Mm-hmm. So she also wasn't doing it in isolation. She was allowing that to be, I mean, it was an issue that everybody was aware of. She didn't disclose personal stuff. But she was public about how she was addressing it. And I just thought that was, it was really beautifully done. And a challenging issue. So policies. Policies might also mean, what kind of statements do we make as a congregation? You know, there are ways that denominations, and I don't know specifically the Lutheran, like, I think you can become a reconciling, is it reconciling in Christ?
Yeah.
You can become a reconciling in Christ congregation. But there are so many politics around that, right? Like, it's wonderful when congregations can, but what are the limitations in congregations that have not taken that step or choose not to take that step? What's going on? How do we begin to have those dialogues? Oftentimes there's some divides happen. I know after the ELCA vote, I'm on the border of Minnesota. In my community, there were churches that split. There were churches that decided they'll stay ELCA, but they made a public vote not to support the sexuality statement. It was really interesting. And then people leaving those churches because of that, finding other churches. I mean, it was an interesting time to especially be in the Midwest, which is so, I mean, I'm in walking distance to 3 Lutheran churches from my house. it was really interesting to be in that particular setting as these conversations were happening, both for good and for not so great. I see Jim here. Yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna comment because I was at Luther Seminary in 2009 and just on the heels of that vote. And when that came in, of course, everybody wanted to know, how are you going to train your pastors? And the answer to your question will be whether we fund you or not. So there were, you know what I mean, there were a lot of things that were trying to hold tension. Yeah, we had a professor who I really love, and he came in, and we had all these debates going on. Where do we fall? Where does the seminary fall? What does this mean? Or does that fall in your own faith? And we had a professor come in, and he was just livid after the conversation because he thought it was the dumbest thing ever that we even had to debate whether this was okay or not. That why are we having this conversation? He lightened it by saying, at the heels of that, saying we have more important issues to be debating, and that was if the aliens would land, how would that affect your theology? So I kind of went from like very serious where the seminary was at that time in these really strong debates back and forth to trying to lighten that load a little
bit. Well, and this,
you can see where that conflict began even then as far as training and how were people trained. And
how influential is that? And where you even start your training on how to to be a facilitator and a leader. What your comments made me think of is something that I hadn't thought of saying today, but it's so important to say, because I say this in my own community all the time. What oftentimes I hear, and again, as I'm in this like particular role on the pastor parishioner committee, I hear about why people sometimes leave my faith community. And what's been interesting is this most recently, it's been a lot of, well, the pastor's too political. She is no more political than our last pastor. But our last pastor was a man. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to also think about the intersection of sexism, who gets to take certain stands, and how do communities respond to them, even when they're not aware of it. Because I think if I walked around to those particular families who left and said, that was sexist, you were here through the other pastor, and the other pastor was much more political, they would be like, no, we're not. You know, like, how dare you? But we have to think about the way these ideas are institutionalized and that they do make a difference. Another thing that I think is so important with that statement is it's too political. The church has always been a place of political action. Church has always been political. Always, always, always. If that book that we read from and worship is not the most political piece of literature that you have ever seen, we're in different worlds. Christianity is political. Jesus was political. Jesus was a social justice activist. And you might be like, she needs to shut up now. This is my truth. And so to say that, okay, now we're going to decide that this group of people is too much and it's too political and we don't want to go there, I think really is a rejection of beyond decades, thousands of years of history. And so these are sometimes hard conversations, but I think important conversations to have with people. When the reasoning, like, we shouldn't talk about it, because you'll hear a lot of reasons why we shouldn't go there. We shouldn't go there because it's too political. Well, what isn't political? What about the crucifixion isn't political?
Yeah.
You know, it's all political. But this is also about people and how we view the value of people and the worth of people and people's salvation. And it is scary because the rhetoric and the religious argument against trans people has to do with salvation, right? That this is somehow a rejection of God, that people are rejecting that they were made in the likeness of God's image, and that can be really scary. And that's something we talked about the other day in terms of, you know, parents who feel like they're responsible for their children's salvation and they get the message that this is somehow an abomination and it's their job to save their child. They won't get to spend eternity with their child if they can't fix this problem. But that comes from a place of believing this is a problem. Well, how does that change if we believe that all people are inherently valued? All people are inherently made in the likeness and image of God. That changes the conversation. That's a hard change. I'm not saying you just bust that out in a conversation and people are like, oh, good point, okay. It doesn't quite happen that way because this isn't one conversation. This is an ongoing dialogue. It's a commitment to inclusion that it might take a long time for some people, but over time, that people change over time, right? Especially if you have a lifetime of a certain set of beliefs. And now we're inviting people to change those beliefs and think differently. Like, as a family therapist, I'm trained in systems theory, and systems like homeostasis. Systems do not like change. Churches do not like change. Anybody feel me there? Churches don't like change, even though we need to change. We have a changing world with changing issues, and we're called to embrace change. We still don't like it, and we're uncomfortable, and we're going to push back, you know, and try and keep that from happening. But as much as we're keeping it from happening, it's happening anyway. So how do we do that? I wanted 6 and 7, I think, are just so incredibly, also incredible. I say that for every number. Oh, this is so incredibly important. But this is also about how do we exist in a larger community, right? Because our churches sometimes feel like bubbles, but we're part of larger communities. So what do we do in terms of our outreach to let people know that there's a place for them? And that can look lots of different ways. Some churches are really on the forefront. They're doing things like wearing t-shirts and marching in GLBT pride parades. Other people are doing things like hosting support group meetings in their basement once a week or once a month. Others might do things like my congregation last year. I was a group of people that the day after the Pulse shootings, we got together, we reached our contacts, we contacted the media, and held a vigil that night, and it was standing room only. And we had people from our local mosque come and speak. We had people from different, the Latina support organization came and spoke. You know, it was really powerful and intergenerational and interfaith. People from the community came because we needed a place to be together to honor this tragedy that had happened and to try and make sense of it in a community of other people who wanted to be supportive. And it was something that we did in less than 24 hours, but it took my pastor saying, this space is welcoming. This can happen in this space. She also is very clear, and this has been written into policy, I'm going to go back to policy for a second, written into policy and passed by the church council, that any organization that wants to rent space or hold an event in our church, because oftentimes our church spaces are event spaces as well, have to be inclusive. So if you are an organization that is going to reject a certain group of people, then unfortunately that doesn't fit the values of our church, and therefore this isn't the right meeting space for you. So if you are exclusive to trans people, you're, you know, unfortunately, unless you can change that, the event isn't welcome in our space. And that's just another way we're sending a very clear message. And what happened with another church in our community is they were renting their space to another church that had lost their physical space, and they actually changed their policy. Now, they didn't become like the most inclusive pride marchers. But what they did say is, you know, this is an area we need to think more about. We're going to move from being outright saying, no, you're not welcome here if you're LGBT, to saying, this is a place where all people are welcome. We still have work to do in this area. So they weren't going to preach against it anymore. Now, they weren't being inclusive necessarily, but what a wonderful thing that by having that policy, it helped to start a dialogue between these two pastors. And they continue to have that conversation. So there are ways that this kind of policy, outreach, space makes a difference. So there's many ways to do outreach. I think the support group is, having support groups is really important. You know, committing that space to organizations who need safe places. And at the same time, sometimes churches aren't the spaces to have them. When people have experienced rejection from faith communities, they might not want to go to a support group that meets in a faith setting. So sometimes that means that churches might take up a collection to help support a local organization who has a different brick and mortar place. Those are important outreach kinds of activities. But I want to get back to political and social action, and that is, I think, one of the most powerful experiences I've had since I've been in North Dakota was when I was in Bismarck testifying on the anti-discrimination bill, because in the state of North Dakota, as I mentioned, some of you heard me say this, it's legal to fire people and kick them out of their housing if you suspect they might be LGBT. But the people who are most impacted by that are transgender people. And so if you suspect they're transgender, you can fire them with no consequence. You can kick them out of their housing with no consequence. And so there was a bill to change that. It's gone up several times and has not yet passed. But we still go in every legislative session, where every other year, we go in droves and we submit testimony, and we go and testify in front of the Committee on Health and Human Services. And what's been very powerful is when clergy show up in their clergy garb on the side of justice and inclusion. So that is a way, you know, in regards to political and social action, where clergy have said, this is what we think is right, and they don't even necessarily, some will testify. So we've had clergy that have gone up and testified and talked about how important it is, because the testimony against oftentimes comes from religious leaders that are not inclusive, that they want to make sure that there is record of inclusive faith communities. We've also had pastors that show up and they don't speak, but they're just there sitting with the people that are supporting LGBT people as a visual representation for the committee. You know, these are very powerful acts of social justice. There have been letters that have been written from faith communities, and all the people will sign on, but they also list the name of their faith community. And that can be done at the state, local, federal level when it comes to policies. It could be a school board policy. But there are many ways that we are politicizing the lives of trans people at every level of government right now. From schools all the way up to Title IX and federal action. So if you think about your identity and who you are in the world, And if you had to turn on the news when you're not at Holden, every time you opened up your news feed, every time you saw some kind of media, there was something about an aspect of your identity that people were debating. What would that feel like? You know, and what does it mean to be a part of a faith community that says, this is your safe place, and we're going to be engaged. We're not only going to welcome you, but we're going to be engaged in changing these experiences on a larger level. That's really powerful. And then my final point, and I know we're getting to the end here, is ritual. And how do we invite trans and gender diverse people into the full life of the church? You know, are people invited to stand at the pulpit, to be acolytes, to read scripture, to lead a Bible study, to host an event in their home? You know, it's sometimes that's a matter of going and inviting them. You know, we oftentimes in churches will have a sign up. You know, like, if you'd like to do this, come sign up. It really says something when somebody who's in a lead, maybe on the council or in a leadership position, approaches somebody who maybe has disclosed or not disclosed their identity, but make sure that they know that they're included. Have you thought about joining the choir? Would you like to host this event? Yeah, we have the sign up, but sometimes that just one-on-one conversation saying, we think, you know, I think you would be really wonderful at, you know, reading scripture on Sundays. That's something you'd be comfortable doing. It also sends a message of inclusion. And it lets people know that they're seen and they're welcome. So we can think about ritual and sometimes how ritual is also gendered and how we might change that. So anyway, I feel like I'm talking a lot. What, any questions, comments, thoughts, ideas, things that you're thinking about in your own communities?
Well, I have what's a different experience in that I'm a member of an Episcopal church who has an associate priest for formation whose main job is as a professor of Lutheran studies at Pacific Lutheran University, who is married to another man in the congregation. This is known to everybody. So it's pretty clear that we're a welcoming church.
You bring up a great point, actually. And I'm going to say that that's also important, visibility, right? When we do have people that are willing to be visible, that sends a very, very strong message. We have in the Fargo-Moorhead area, and it's in one of our Lutheran churches for the first time, an out gay man who's also married, who's come to serve one of our congregations, has had some very positive press in the media, has been willing to be very public, and that sends a very strong message, especially other churches who are willing to then collaborate with that church on different community action, also sends a strong message. The piece that gets challenging along with that is remembering that transphobia occurs within the LGBT community. There are many, many very transphobic gay and lesbian people. And so that's sometimes surprising to folks, but especially in church community and political action. That, like, and there's two sides to that. That also gets very interesting, because I actually even hosted a panel one time in one of my classes where a trans person came and was speaking on the panel, and I had some very socially conservative religious women that were in the class, and this trans person said, you know, I identify as a woman, but I am a follower of Jesus, and I believe in the Bible, and I don't think I could be with a woman ever again. No, when that person had lived as a man for part of their life, they had been with women, and now that they're trans, because their belief that being gay was wrong, they chose to be celibate after their transition. And I remember sitting in that class, it was one of those moments as an educator that I was dumbfounded and stunned and didn't know what to do, because the women applauded him. Her. Excuse me. Oh gosh, I just misgendered. The women applauded her. So they were willing to embrace her gender identity, but now they were saying, your sexual orientation, like, that's great that you're choosing to be celibate, because to be a lesbian would be wrong. It was very interesting, and it was not my proudest moment in the classroom. Because it was really a moment of, I didn't see that coming. But I should, because that happens. It happens within the LGBT community as well, where lesbian, gay, bisexual, you know, people whose sexual orientations might be more diverse aren't necessarily embracing of trans people. I hear in my own social communities, like transphobic comments and jokes being made on a regular basis. So I say that because as we're having these conversations in our faith communities, gay, lesbian, bisexual people need to be part of these these conversations about trans inclusion as well. Don't assume that everybody gets it. That's really important. I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, you didn't bring that up, but that made me think of that particular piece. Because there's sometimes some assumptions. I know in my own faith community, there was assumptions. We have a large number of LGBT people that do attend my church, but there was an assumption when we were doing our adult ed series on trans inclusion that the gay and lesbian members kind of got it and already knew. And in some ways, some of the straight-identified cisgender church members kind of looked to them to being experts. And some of the things that were said in our group discussions were problematic. You know, because they weren't. They hadn't done the work to really understand their gender identity. But yet they were kind of viewed as having more expertise because they were part of a larger group of people who are marginalized based on gender identity and sexual orientation. Does that make sense to everyone? I feel like I don't throw anybody under the bus. I come from a really great community, but at the same time, that was a learning curve for people, I think. And then it was hard as a facilitator saying, you know, how do you encourage dialogue, but then also say, let's stop there for a second. Let's talk about that a little bit more, because, you know, the comment might have been something that could be pretty offensive. And that's where it's also important in those educational moments that it was all people who are cisgender or not transgender that were having those conversations together, because it's important that we learn from each other rather than looking, as I think I mentioned earlier, avoiding looking to marginalized groups to educate you about your privilege, right? So when you don't have to worry about where you go to the bathroom or how people are going to name you or the way people are going to treat you or people making fun of you or when you try to just try on clothing in a department store, when you don't have to worry about that, let's not ask the people who do to teach you about what that feels like. Makes sense to everyone? But that's sometimes the place we want to go because we say, oh, you're the expert. Help me understand your experience because I support you. I love you. I'm going to be there for you. Comes, again, we're back to really good intention. But what's that experience like when you have to be the one that educates everybody else about the way they treat you? They being collective. Well, okay, that calls us to a different kind of accountability. I see him.
That, to me, indicates that binary is the problem. That we need to sort of move away from that because the gay folks are saying, oh yeah, well I'm locked in my thing, my binary thing, but...
Right, and there are lots of gay and lesbian people that really embrace the binary. And there's trans people that embrace the binary too. But, you know, there are plenty of lesbian women that will not date trans women. There are plenty of gay men that will not date trans men. There are plenty that will. And then there's people who don't get it at all, and they're like, well, but if they're trans, I just had this conversation here at Holden, actually. If a person is like a trans man and they're a trans woman and they're dating another woman, then aren't they straight? No, they're not. They are the identity that they identify as. So they might be both identify as lesbians. One might identify as bi, one might identify as gay. I mean, you know, identity is so personal, but what people tend to do is reduce people to their genitals and how they think they have sex. If we think about relationships, sex is important, but aren't people much more complex beings? You know, when people are dating, we don't always reduce it to sex. So why are we with that particular group of people? And we rely on them for their own knowing. So if a couple says that they are a lesbian couple, then they're a lesbian couple. There's also, you know, what's important about assumptions in that regard too, are that they're what's called a mixed orientation relationship. Where I know couples where they 20 years married straight couple, and the husband discloses, I cannot go on unless I just embrace my true identity. I've always identified as a woman. I've kept it a secret, but I can't do it anymore. And they decide to stay together. So the husband who is transitioning to live as a woman, which that feels like they match their identity, is still partnered with their wife who's always identified as straight. So people might read them as a lesbian couple, but they are how they identify. Like, what does that make them? Well, who that matters to are always outsiders. That question is always asked of outsiders, right? And is it our business? Why do we need to know that? I mean, we're curious, so I'm not saying that you're not going to wonder and that it's bad to wonder, But when we actually go to have to ask those questions, well, why are we asking those questions to be better support people? Or are we asking those questions because we're just so curious, maybe a little nosy? You know, that's where we're like, stop yourself. Like, that's where we do our own self checks. Like, why am I asking this question? Rather than saying, well, what are you now? Or are you a gay couple now? Say, how can I support you? What do you need? You know, and if people want to disclose that aspect of their relationship to you, they will. But I'm always shocked by the kinds of questions that people get in my work, because people share their stories with me as a therapist. The kinds of questions they get on a regular basis and how often they're having to respond to those kinds of questions when maybe they're just struggling themselves. You know, if you think about what a marriage, I mean, some marriages, it's just, I said my vows and I love you no matter what. We're staying together. Like, I'm going to figure this out with you. Other people really struggle. Other couples get divorced, you know, but the couples that struggle especially, do you think they need a bunch of people asking them questions about their identity? Not so much. It's not helpful, you know. So that just, you know, more questions around these kinds of issues. Anyway, I realize we are at time. So if there's any more questions or comments, please feel free if you want to stick around and talk some more or come talk to me. So yeah, so thank you so much for being here. I feel like I talked to you a lot. So I, you know, if you have anything you want to say, please do.
Thank you so much, Kristen.
Thank you. My philosophy is this is what Holden is all about. And I think, oh, he just left, but just to push us to the edge, right?
Well, and if you have feedback,
yes,
I would love it. So please, yes, feel free to email me. Like, and if it's critical feedback too, that helps me. So please don't hold back if you do have some feedback that you think would improve or be more helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah,
so
thank you.